one into the night, deep into right, way out of here.
Swung on,
did it,
crushed, and the Phillies are going to lead it.
Harper, the swing of his life.
The 0-2 pitch, swing and a miss. Struck him out.
From WHYY, it is hitting season. Hey there, podcast pals. I'm John Stolness from The Good Fight. You can follow me on X and Blue Sky at John Stolness. Coming up, Phillies lose another series, this one to the Chicago Cubs. They win the first game of the series on Monday and then have their doors blown off them on Tuesday and Wednesday night. Wednesday's game particularly ugly, an 11-2 loss to Chicago. We're going to get into all that. And really, folks, just everything with this team right now is just kind of awful. So we'll talk about the Jesus Luzardo implosion. We'll talk about the offense's inconsistency, and we'll get into some specifics there. Coming into the game on Wednesday, I felt the Phillies had the unluckiest pitching staff in baseball. Might have to amend that just a little bit. And we'll talk a little Zach Wheeler as well, and some other things we might get to here on the podcast if we have time. Justin Clue joining me here for the midweek edition of the podcast. You can follow him on Blue Sky at Justin Clue. He, of course, writes for Baseball Prospectus, and he does a couple of podcasts over at our Hitting Season Patreon, The Dirty Inning and Absolutely Hammered. This Jesus Luzardo start might one day be a Dirty Inning candidate. And look what I got in the mail today, Justin.
Hooray!
Summer of the Cheap Wieners is here.
That's that fantastic new book, Summer of the Cheap Wieners, about how the 1941 Phillies were playing ball in a terrible way while Joe DiMaggio was making history one magical American summer in 1941. I don't know too much about it, but I've heard some things.
You've heard some good things. Yes, we're not. This show is not on video this episode, so it'll be sitting in the background right behind me whenever we do a video show, so everybody sees it. But
excellent set yesterday. Dressing. If you ever read it someday, it's got a couple pages in it, so it's mm-hmm. It can be more than set dressing. I promise.
That's right.
You.
Well,
but
it just doubles
the value.
I'm doing both. I've already read it. I read it when in the preliminary stages before it was published, and thoroughly enjoyed it. Now getting to read it a second time, reminded of some of the good stories in there. But anyway, yes, you can get that at brooklinebooks.com. That's Justin's new book, Summer of the Cheap Wieners. Justin, how you feeling, pal?
Well, if Bo Bichette's not careful, he could be playing for the Mets next year, too. I just wanted to, knowing what this show was going to be about, I wanted to just jump in here at the beginning and say that over the winter I talked a lot about how, well, the Phillies represent a team that's running it back, and the Mets mm-hmm. represent a team that kind of blew up their core, and they're going to be, like, the narrative all season will be, well, whatever's happening to one of them means that plan worked and the other one didn't. But what we're learning here in the beginning of the season is that both ideas were terrible. So now I don't know really how to proceed, and I guess neither does anyone else in baseball.
Nope. Maybe we should have done what the Atlanta Braves did, which is also I'm not really sure exactly what the Atlanta Braves did. Was just hope everybody got healthy, kind of because they're off to a real good start. Yeah, and the Mets. If you think the Phillies are off to a bad start, the Mets are. Interesting, off to an even worse start, which is hard to believe. Although one game separates them in the standings right now, it is a mess in the National League East. And the Phillies obviously are our concern. And just the continuation. I mean, we can dive into all the numbers and we can dive into all the individual performances of this team. But it really does right now with this team. It's a different group of players every night playing terrible baseball, largely. I mean, the Phillies are mixing in like a really encouraging game here and there. It's like really one out of every two games. They are losing every series right now. One out of every two games, they play well. And then two out of every three games, they play really poorly. And this is what we've seen over the last couple of weeks, really since the season began. Their negative 25 run differential is the worst at any point of the regular season for them, going back to exactly 3 years ago today, April 15th, 2023. Luke Arcini had that note on Twitter. And that run differential, Justin, is third worst in baseball. Only the White Sox at negative 33. The San Francisco Giants at negative 27, who beat the Phillies 2 out of 3 in San Francisco last week, have a worse run differential than the Phillies. Now, maybe this should make Phillies fans feel a little bit better. The team that's at negative 24 right behind the Phillies is the defending American League pennant winners, the Toronto Blue Jays, who are off to a little bit of a rough start. But really everything is awful right now. We've been heaping a lot of blame on the offense, and they didn't do their job here in the last two games of this series. Their inconsistency remains, and it's frustrating, and that's the majority of our focus, because that's been the big problem over the last few years. But the pitching has been wildly inconsistent. And Jesus Luzardo on Wednesday night, 9 runs, 8 earned, 12 hits, a 7.94 ERA on the season. He's given up 5 or more runs in 3 of his 4 starts this season. A lot of the damage being done second and third time through the order. A lot of damage being done from the stretch, Justin. It's really confounding because the stuff looks great early, and then it all falls apart. And so, and we've seen this with some of the other pitchers here in the early going too. So it's really everything. The defense has been brutal. Trey Turner with another terrible error here on Wednesday night. There's not a single facet of the sport that the Phillies are doing well consistently right now.
The Cubs were a bottom 10 team in batting average and slugging until from the beginning of the season until April 12th before this series started. They were definitively mid in most offensive categories until April 12th. They averaged 3.6 runs per game until April 12th, and in this series they averaged 9.3 runs per game. So, yeah, the pitching staff wasn't super holding up against an offense that, you know, really shouldn't be too hard to stop. So, yeah, and this is like an ongoing pattern now. We've seen this team and this pitching staff struggle to contain the dynamic offenses of the Washington Nationals and the Colorado Rockies and the San Francisco Giants and all these teams that were either projected to be very poor and were are on track to fulfill those projections since the Phillies played them, or teams that used the Phillies as kind of a, you know, get right quick scheme that they were just able to take advantage of. And that's when you really start to, I feel like, get demoralized, is when other struggling teams start using you to play better, yeah. Especially when you're the Phillies, a team that's, you know, supposed to be a top 5, top 3 team in the National League, and you're seeing all these Central Division teams just taking their turns beating them up. So, yeah, I mean, you know, everybody's bringing up tipping pitches with Luzardo because that was the last time he got blown up this badly in such quick succession. It was because of an issue like that. Can't really say if that's really what's going on here, but ultimately, as far as like the starting pitching goes, consistency is more valuable than perfection. You know, and you've invested in this pitching staff a lot, some guys more than once. This has to work. And I don't mean they have to get more consistent or they won't win the World Series, because that's either going to happen or it's not. But this has to work because there's too much money and time invested in the rotation for it to be a part of the problem. So I'm sure Zach Wheeler wants to return and be tasked with hoisting the team onto his 36-year-old, thankfully blood clot-free shoulder. But he shouldn't have to do that between the All-Star NL Cy Young runner-up and the other NL Cy Young finisher, and then the at one point top prospect in all of baseball, according to Baseball America. And even the self-sabotaging former All-Star. Somebody's got to be able to throw 6 good innings for a couple of weeks. Because right now, if this rotation's not working, then nothing's working. And then how are you going to keep winning slightly less than half your games?
Right. And I'm going to get into some of the specifics with the pitching staff in just a few minutes, because it has been, you look at some of the statistics and you could say the Phillies pitching staff has been one of the best in baseball. And then you look at some of the other statistics and you look at what happened on Tuesday and Wednesday night against the Chicago Cubs, and you see a lot of runs and you see a lot of hits, and it doesn't seem like it's a mirage, you know? Luzardo now has, and this is a dirty inning alert for you, Justin. I don't know if you saw this note. Luzardo now has multiple instances in which he's given up 12 or more hits and 9 or more runs in a game as a Philly in fewer than 6 innings. He's the first Phillies pitcher to record multiple such outings since Claude Willoughby and Buzz Phillips both did it in 1930. That's that courtesy of @JHeyKid on Twitter. 1930 Phillies. There's a couple of starts you can look up there. And we mentioned that he's really having trouble his second and third times through the lineup. His first time through the lineup this year has a 0.90 ERA, 12 strikeouts, 10 innings. In his last start, he had a no-hitter going through 4 and then got blitzed for 5 runs and couldn't get out of the 5th inning. His second and third times through the order, a 12.08 ERA. He's given up 22 hits in 12 and two-thirds innings and 17 earned runs, second and third time through the order. And you look at runners on base. This was a problem last year when he was having these issues. Throughout his career, it's been a problem, and I didn't realize it to this extent. In his career with runners on base, in other words, pitching from the stretch, Luzardo has a 9.22 ERA. This year, it's 24.55 pitching out of the stretch. Now, that wasn't a problem all of last year. I mean, he certainly pitched well out of the stretch, you know, for most of the season. But again, he had those blow ups with the Phillies in the middle of the season. So I just, man, what do you make of those numbers? What do you make of all that? I don't know what to make of it all.
I mean, I can't have another Aaron Nola on the team. I can tell you that much.
We can't have
a situation like that resurfacing. So obviously the situation has an explanation. And in a way, I'm almost taking solace in the fact that when Jesus Luzardo gets into a spiral like this, it's so dramatically different from what we know he is capable of that it's such a red flag that it's unavoidable.
So I just saw on X, I'm kind of just keeping it monitored over here after to get post-game comments and stuff. They're saying Luzardo is adamant that it's not pitch tipping, which is obviously what we would all ordinarily think. But they're thinking like it's pitch sequencing, right? Like he's throwing the sinker at inappropriate times, and the sweeper, which was a devastating pitch for him last year, is not as effective with runners on base, and that's been getting knocked around. And so, I mean, at the very least, you know that he went through these troubles last year and worked through them. I have as little faith as I have in Kevin Long right now, I have a lot of faith in Caleb Cotham to diagnose what's going on with Jesus Luzardo, because I feel like the stuff is there. He's healthy, you know? I mean, that's kind of the most important thing. I mean, it's awful right now, but I don't know. Does that give you any, like, the fact that he went through this a season ago and got through it, any comfort to that?
Yeah, to close the loop on that, my comment there is that if he's healthy and not tipping, then the immediacy with which the problem needs to be solved because of the scope of disaster that it seems to be creating is going to spur the Phillies into finding the solution. And also, it's so uncharacteristic of him, like outside of the long stretches of starts where he is an effective starter, where he is the guy who finished seventh in Cy Young voting last year. That just kind of proves that, like, okay, something's off, and it can be corrected because it wasn't off and now it is. So it's not like this is something he came back from a long winter and hasn't been able to figure out. It's just been puzzling. Like, this was so far a containable disaster, just like it was before. And yeah, I feel like the Phillies have the kind of staff that can suss that out and work with, again, what is a part of this team that is just simply too important to fail.
And we'd be remiss to not talk about Aaron Nola's start on Tuesday. Not awful. 5 innings, but gave up 8 hits in those 5 innings. 3 runs. Was staked to an early 3-0 lead with an Edmundo Sosa bomb to dead center field. But he was the offense shut it down after that. Refused to do anything else for the rest of the game. And Aaron Nola had to be perfect. And you know, a 3-run 5-inning outing, it's not a quality start. It's not amazing, but I think I'm kind of take it, you know, from Aaron Nola at this point. Is like your number 4 starter, and it was the bullpen. Tim Mizza, who's been great this year, got blown up in a third of an inning trying to relieve Aaron Nola. So that's kind of what I mean. Like, it's a different couple of guys, different 3 or 4 guys, like every night, offensively, defensively, on the pitching staff, that are finding ways to lose, and that's really what's going on with this team right now, is finding ways to lose.
But sometimes in the case of guys finding ways to lose also find you. And I think that's where stuff like the ball batting average on balls in play for Phillies pitchers is now up to 359. As Matt Winkelman notes, the second highest in the league is 329. So they are up there in as far as bad luck goes. And that you would know that just from watching the games with the amount of diving Phillies infielders that have not corralled a ground ball as it bounced into the outfield grass gleefully. Just the eyeball test alone, you know that the seeing eye single numbers of this pitching staff are through the roof. And as Winkelman notes, this is all going to normalize at some point. And that is, I think, true. This is in some ways anomalous of some early season small sample size chaos. And especially when you consider the Phillies lead in ground balls, they've given up like the most ground balls.
Yeah, so that's what you want.
Yeah, and so, like, eventually ground balls start finding gloves and hits start becoming outs, and that's how teams like the Giants and teams like the Diamondbacks, who I just watched do the same thing to the Orioles, are winning games right now, and that's not how they're going to be winning games as the season goes on.
Right. I put a bunch of numbers together coming into the game on Wednesday for an article I have coming out on The Good Fight on Thursday, where I was really looking at some of the numbers of the pitching staff, and I was making the argument that they were the unluckiest pitching staff in baseball. The numbers have been updated a little bit here, so I'll kind of update them as I go along. But the Phillies came into Wednesday with the second best overall pitching staff in Major League Baseball, according to Fangraph's version of wins above replacement. The Yankees are at 3.6, and the Phillies and Mariners were at 3.5. You're looking at FWAR, the Phillies' whole pitching staff, starters and relievers, were tops in baseball. And yet they came into the game on Wednesday with a 4.62 ERA. I'm going to update these numbers now as I'm looking at them here. And the Phillies are still at 3.5, but the ERA has obviously been adjusted given the Jesus Luzardo start here. The Phillies' ERA now sits at 4.92 on the season. It went from 4.62 to 4.92 thanks to Jesus Luzardo's start here, 26th out of 30 teams in Major League Baseball. So you have the second highest wins above replacement and the 26th ERA in Major League Baseball. And the number that you talked about that Matt Winkelmann hit it on is exactly right. The BABIP, the batting average on balls in play for the Phillies, is astronomical right now. That number is now 359. It came into Wednesday at 354. That number now 359. Opponents, when they put a ball in play against the Phillies, are hitting 359. That is absolutely insane. The next closest is 329, as you mentioned, the Houston Astros. That's the number that they have right now. So that tells you you're dealing with a lot of bad luck. Phillies starters have allowed an ERA of a batting average of 282 coming into the game today. That went up. That's the second highest batting average in Major League Baseball coming into the game, but they have the best ground ball rate. They're getting a ground ball nearly half the time, 49.9%. They have the lowest fly ball rate. They have a low a home run per nine inning rate. Their hard hit rate of 28.5% is second lowest in Major League Baseball. I mean, they have the starters have the third best strikeout rate and walk rate, but a 372 BABIP allowed. Like, it's just so, like, they're doing all of the things outside of Jesus Luzardo here on Wednesday night that you would ask your pitching staff to do, and yet the results are they're getting shelled, and then they have that's why they have this run differential the way they do.
Yep, and I feel like that's kind of the answer when you're looking at numbers that you're like how are they even doing this, and the results on the field are negative. I mean, with enough times watching a baseball season, you know in your head these early results can be indicative of almost nothing. You can go back and look at championship Phillies teams and see they have very similar, if not worse, records than the current Phillies do now. But everybody doesn't like watching this kind of thing, or even when it's early in the season. That being said, the kind of chaotic numbers that sort of don't add up are indicative more so that there are better things waiting to be evened out with this team. And frankly, with the amount of parity in baseball across all of baseball right now, it's kind of curious to see what's going to change. Is everyone's luck going to change at the same time this year? How is this going to go down? Some teams are going to find that second gear, and some teams aren't. And I think the Phillies are still a team that is capable of finding that second gear once things start to kind of level out a little more.
Right. The Atlanta Braves are the only team in the division right now with a record over 500. The Marlins, Phillies, Nationals, and Mets are all under 500 at the moment. In the Central, it's like Pittsburgh and Cincinnati are leading the way with St. Louis. But St. Louis, everybody in the NL Central is 500 or better. But they're all right just around 500. You know, you've got the Dodgers doing their thing out west. They're 13-4. The Padres and Diamondbacks are doing pretty well. You know, but it's just like you've got the Blue Jays are struggling at 7-10.
Twins have the most wins in the American League.
Yes.
Things have not settled yet.
Correct. No, things have not settled out. I think that's the big takeaway right now is things have not settled. The Mariners, who almost went to the World Series, are 8-10 on the season, trailing the Angels in the American League West, among other teams. So, you're right. It's just so the pitching staff, I feel like I'm not as panicked about. I'm not as panicked about the bullpen. I'm not panicked about Jesus Luzardo or the other starters. I'm looking forward to Zach Wheeler coming back. Sounds like he might have another couple of starts for Redding, at least one for sure. Maybe a second one after his last start. We saw the velocity tick up just a little bit. So we have the offense. I mean, we have the pitching staff. We have Jesus Luzardo start on Wednesday, but the offense continues to be the thing that frustrates and worries everyone the most, because that has been the problem that's existed the longest. And again, still it's early, but it's It's not getting any better, at least not yet. Trey Turner hits a leadoff home run on Wednesday, and then the Phillies scored one additional run the rest of the way. We saw that with Edmundo Sosa's early three-run home run. I mean, we've seen a couple of games against Colorado, right, where they got out to an early lead against the Cubs in the series opener, where they got out and the bats came out red hot, and it looked like the Phillies were on their way to a nice home series win against the Cubs. And then it just, that's the thing with this offense. Like, they die. It's like it's like when you've got a hose and you kind of kink the hose and the water just stops trickling out. Like, you just don't know when somebody's going to unkink the hose, and you know, you get a little bit of water flow for a little bit. Two runs on five hits Wednesday night against Shota Imanaga, who's a very good left-handed pitcher, but he tallied up 26 swings and misses against the Phillies in this game. That is the most in a single outing by any pitcher against any team so far this year. The most in a single outing against the Phillies since Robbie Ray in 2021. And it's the third most in the StatCast era, going back to 2015 against the Phillies. So this is just more of the same. And it's just, it's so frustrating to watch, because there just doesn't look like there's anybody on the team that has any consistent answers.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, with the pitchers, consistency is better than perfection. And, you know, I feel like this is kind of the same conversation you've been having about this team. They are, you know, there's a certain point you kind of reach where you say the refrain you're hearing from guys like Trey Turner after another loss, after another bummer, where they're either getting their doors blown off or they couldn't quite mount the comeback, is that they know they have to play better. And I get why you say that, because it's the closest thing to actually playing better that you have any control of. So you just say, I know I have to play better. But the question is never, do you know you have to play better? The question is always, isn't, do you know you have to play better? The question is, can you? And how? When will that happen? I think some of the comforting part here is that, would you say we've like not seen anything from these Phillies that we haven't seen before? Because I wouldn't. Yeah. I wouldn't say this is like a new breed of struggles. No. Whereas somebody like the Mets, I would say this might be a deeper hole than they thought they were going to be in. Like, the losing six straight games, or still playing the Dodgers tonight as we speak, but they lost six straight games. They got shut out by the Twins how many times in a row? Twice at least. Yeah. Like, they were
the A's shut them out a couple times in back-to-back games. Yeah.
Yeah. So like, it is both discouraging and encouraging to see the Phillies in this way. But as far as like this being some sort of new kind of disaster, no, this is the infuriating way in with which this team plays baseball, for the last couple of years, at least. You know, the Mets are low, and you can say it's in a way you've seen before, but yeah, like I said, it's lower than the Phillies, but they're already having, like I heard you and Liz in the last episode, I've also heard some Mets fans starting a soft talk about manager seats getting hotter. So they're also dealing with that same exact parallel talk of potentially sending down Carson Bench alone because he looks lost at the plate. There's like some sour grapes about how Brandon Nimmo is looking pretty good with the Rangers, and Pete Alonso is starting to find his footing a little bit with the Orioles, and the guys who replaced them in New York haven't done that. So we've seen the Phillies do this and turn the ship back upright. It can still happen. But I maintain that the part that worries me is that even let's say they start, like, they win a couple series in a row here and people generally consider them a more effective team. You know, sure, that happens. But I still do maintain there's some screws loose on this team's engine, like somewhere in the middle. There's stuff that's off, and we don't have to go looking for it to know that. I think, you know, this stuff has a way of spilling out in any case. So I don't know exactly, you know, how you want to characterize it. If it's vibes, if it's, you know, people just aren't, like, you know, it's just not a good time or whatever. Like, they're just struggling to get their footing here at the beginning, and they're tired of going through this process. Like, I don't know. I don't know what it is, but something in the middle of this team just has, you know, it continues to feel a little off.
Yeah, well, you can't keep trying to do the same thing over and over again and getting the same results and not see guys get frustrated. I mean, there's a psychology involved in you know, being in Sisyphus trying to roll that boulder up the hill, you know? And, you know, like Liz and I did talk about Rob Thompson and Kevin Long, and, you know, it's at some point you're going to push a button, and I don't know when that is or who that is, but it's a lot easier to replace Kevin Long than it is to try and figure out, a way to fix your third base problem, or fix or fix Bryson Stott so that he's not continually fooling people into thinking that he's going to be a good hitter, you know, or, you know, getting, you know, spending more than 1 year, $10 million on an outfielder for once would be a nice change of pace, a good way to get some new blood into a lineup that, you know, that has an atrophy, you know, that doesn't have like atrophied muscles or whatever. I mean, I don't know what, you know, they keep talking about like all these different lineup changes. You know, why are you hitting him here? Why are you hitting him here? Man, it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter. No one's hitting. No one's hitting, and no one's consistent. And you're right. They probably will turn this around. The offense probably will get going. But I think there is a part of me that wonders, as this team has gotten older and with the start this team's gotten off to, could we be looking at a 2012? Right? I mean, could we be looking at a situation where things spiral out of control, or a 1979, or whatever season you want to compare it to, but a season with high expectations that starts off bad and just never really gets back on track. Now, in an era of three wild cards, it's really hard to bury yourself early. And the Phillies certainly have not done that. They have not buried themselves early. But I will say every team has a shelf life, and every team has those years where they take a big step backwards. We've seen it with the Braves the last couple of years. We've seen it with the Mets. We've seen it with other teams. Maybe it's the Phillies' turn. I don't know for sure. It just there's like you said, because you have these other things going on where it feels like there's like a screw loose in a couple of different places. You know, I think we're going to see a coaching change at some point. I think we're going to see something like that. It almost has to happen. Otherwise, we're just doing the same thing.
Yeah, but ultimately, I think that all of this is stuff that will be problems if we're still having these same conversations, you know, let's say a couple of weeks from now. I think this is still within the cage of early season statistical anomalies and poor luck. I think that has a lot to do with this so far. That being said, you know, yeah, the offense is going to be as inconsistent as it has been because it's made up of inconsistent hitters. It's the starting pitching you're going to see solidify, and hopefully the bullpen kind of right itself here too, because they've had a couple of bummers the last couple days as well.
Yeah, it's just they're getting blown out, you know, and mm-hmm. that's what's really hard to watch, you know. Yeah. Like I remember some of those late 80s teams were, you know, they came into the season with expectations. They go, maybe this group could be pretty good, and they just every night it's like 8-1, 10-2. You know, you're just getting blown out where you don't have a chance, and that's what we got right now. It's like there's no aspect of the team that's working. You know,
It's really scary to feel like there's no stopper in your rotation. Which again, it feels too dramatic to be saying right now. But like this cycle through the rotation kind of feels like, yeah, you're kind of waiting for the guy who's going to step up and shut down a lineup just so everybody can get their heads above water, and that hasn't super happened.
No, it sure has not. So what would you do right now with poor Alec Bohm? You know, I mean, I just all the stuff he's got going on off the field and the start that he's gotten off to here in 2026, coming into Wednesday with a 153 batting average. I know he got the start here on Wednesday, went 0-for-3, the batting average down to 145. With a 4.27 OPS, and there's people calling for Edmundo Sosa to really just kind of take over for him for an extended period of time. And we, you know, Edmundo Sosa is a utility infielder, one of the best in baseball for a reason. And frankly, they kind of need him to backstop Bryson Stott also, who is off to a really rotten start. Bryson Stott in this game. Actually, no, he got the night off against Imanaga on Wednesday night. So, yeah, you had Edmundo Sosa playing second base, starting at second for Bryson Stott. He did not get in this game. But Stott lugging around a pretty awful batting average. I mean, it's just, I don't want to overexpose Edmundo Sosa, but he gives you a better chance to win right now than Bryson Stott, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, and Alec Bohm.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with that. If you're somebody who's like, you know, watching the games and you want to ride the hot hand, that's the guy you go with. But, I mean, that was the first word I was going to use, overexposed. We've seen this before. We've seen this before in a couple of ways. One, we've seen what Rob Thompson thinks of the concept of going with the hotter hitter. He didn't really do that. he goes by the plan, and he goes by what he said he was going to go by a couple of days ago. Like, he tends to stick with that. So that kind of is the first thing that makes that not really an option. Secondly, the word overexposed is the first thing that pops into your head, because that is what happens to Edmundo Sosa in this situation every time. Every time. He comes out and he's hitting 500 for like his first 15 games or whatever. And then there's a drop off because, of course, there's a drop off because he's not a starting player. He's a utility player. And like you said, he's the most valuable utility player in baseball, and probably one of the best pickups Dave Dombrowski had since coming to the Phillies. Yep. I mean, just a terrific addition to this team. But he's playing a role of utility guy. And not only is he needed elsewhere at times, he will get overexposed because that is simply what he is. That's the kind of player he is. They will adjust. He will stop hitting and making solid contact, and then you've got another situation on your hands. So I think he's best in the role he's got, and keep him there. This is not because I love the idea of seeing more of Alec Bohm struggling and going through what he's going through, but ultimately you don't want to ruin another player trying to fix another player.
Right. No, and that's the thing, is like you can't overexpose Edmundo, but I do think he's going to play more. I think he's going to get more time in place of Alec Bohm at third base, and I think he absolutely should. Mm-hmm. I will say this about Alec Bohm, and again, a lot going on with him right now. Trying to have compassion with all of the things that are going on with the legal situation with his family.
This is about long before this, though. Yeah. Like we've seen Alec Bohm do some things well.
I know,
not
you're
this
right.
year. But we have seen it. We've seen him make Mike Schmidt-like players at third. Not a lot, but it has happened at least a time or two. We've seen him play adequate third base a lot of the time. We've seen him lead the team in RBI, partially because of lineup placement, but also because he came through when he needed to. Is he a cleanup hitter? No, he should not be in cleanup on this team. There should be a better person filling the cleanup role on this team. Now, maybe all that stuff I just listed are just memories. Maybe those are reasons to keep him. But I think that we know, as valuable as those contributions have been, there's also the inconsistency, the numerous poor defensive moments, the thing he did in the playoffs once that was bad enough to be the other time Rob Thompson benched a player. I will quote the 2026 BP annual about Alec Bohm. After years of flashing more or less, but always ending up right in the middle, he shouldn't be counted on for more. That means these Phillies are messy and he's part of the mess because they know who he is. There's no question mark over what exactly Alec Bohm's going to give you. You know what he's going to give you. And in a way, that's a precious commodity, like that level of information and assuredness. And yeah, sure. Just throwing Bryson Stott in here as well. He typically gets a more positive outlook than Bohm, I think, because he's better at like speed and defense than Bohm is at anything. But Stott's had a bit of a different road and really went from one of the worst to among the best at his position at different periods last year. And that seemed like it was continuing, but now it looks like, who knows? And he's had arm problems, first with this nerve issue, and then he hyperextended it at one point. The turnaround wasn't supposed to be this necessary with him, and then when it was supposed to be like a year and a half ago. But the thing that you kind of land on with both of these guys, and the reason that I think these are the guys people were talking about perhaps moving on from in the winter when they were talking about making bigger changes to the team, is that if Alec Bohm or Bryson Stott went to Baltimore or Minnesota or Detroit, or had, if Dave Dombrowski does business with any other teams, I'm not sure, but if they went to one of those teams and they hit 300 for the rest of the season, 25 homers, helped that team make the postseason, like, would you be mad? Of course, maybe at first, but like not in a real way, because after the initial sting, every sane person would be able to say that the Phillies gave Alec Bohm and Bryson Stott enough of a shot. If some coach somewhere else unlocks something, then all that means is he wasn't hearing what he needed to hear with the Phillies, and that wasn't going to change either. So no one could blame the Phillies front office for trading either of these guys. You could blame maybe Phillies development and like the hitting coach squad, and like maybe you could blame those people not being able to dig that hitter out, but you couldn't blame the front office. So I think end of the day, either one of these guys could wind up better somewhere else. But if I'm the Phillies and if I hear a trade offer I like, I'm making the move. It's a valuable commodity in baseball to know what you have, and the Phillies know what they have in both of these guys.
And I'll say, I think Bryson Stott has more trade value, but they didn't.
Absolutely. That was going to be my other point, is that the phone's also not really ringing too loud
right
now.
Yeah, that's the thing. They tried to trade Alec Bohm the last 2 years and haven't found – no one's given them a deal that they – now, is that the Phillies overvaluing Alec Bohm, or is that other teams undervaluing Alec Bohm? Or at least maybe more accurately – evaluating Alec Bohm. And I still hear some, you know, commentators, you know, Bohm's a really good player. No, he's not. He's not a really good player. He's an average player. He's fine.
He's like a definitively average player. He really is. Like,
yeah, he's definitively average, and that's fine. But, you know, there needs to be other bigger bats in that lineup in order to make it so that he's not getting quite as much attention. And they haven't been able to fill the lineup out to do that. But we all know this. I mean, we've said this a million times. This is nothing new. So just real quick before we get to I want to talk about Justin Crawford and Andrew Painter here in just a second, but just some injury news for the Phillies. The bullpen continues to be in flux. The Phillies have lost two relievers in the last 3 days to the injured list. On Monday, they placed Jonathan Bolin on the 15-day injured list. Bolin had been pitching really well as a right-hander out of the bullpen, throwing really hard. On Wednesday night, Zach Pop joined him in the bullpen. He had a 3.68 ERA through his first seven games with the team. He suffered a right calf strain on Tuesday night after opening the game for Andrew Painter on Sunday. It's a mild strain. It doesn't seem like it's going to keep him out for too terribly long. So Kyle Backus is back from AAA Lehigh Valley. He was originally sent down when Orion Kerkering came back. So you've got Backus back up, and you've got Orion Kerkering there, but Zach Pop and Jonathan Bolin hitting the injured list for the Phillies out of the bullpen. All right, Justin, last thing before we wrap up, there have been a couple of rookie contract extensions that came down this week. Then, you know, the Phillies have a couple rookies on their roster. So the question starts getting asked, could the Phillies do something similar? The Tigers signed their super rookie, Philadelphia area native Kevin McGonigal, 21 years old, to an 8-year, $150 million contract extension through 2034. He's off to a phenomenal start this year for Detroit. And the Pirates locked up their super stud, the top prospect in baseball, who's also gotten off to a pretty good start here, 19-year-old Connor Griffin, to a 9-year, $140 million deal. So some folks are asking, with a collective bargaining agreement expected to expire after 2026, the next round of negotiations could be contentious, ugly, whatever word you want to use. You know, who knows what the future is going to be with a salary cap, a salary floor, luxury tax rules, all that kind of stuff. And if you would, what would a contract look like for Justin Crawford and or Andrew Painter? It seems early to me to sign one of those two guys to a contract extension. I mean, McGonigal and Griffin are super, like, the studs of the rookie class, but Crawford and Painter both gotten off to really good starts for the Phillies. So what are your thoughts on extending them now?
Well, I'll tell you what, in Ken Rosenthal's write-up of teams that are extending these young players and these rookie players all across baseball, you know who got name-checked? Scott Kingery.
Yep.
Who signed a 6-year, $24 million extension, and this is referenced as one of the players who underperforms in his contract, because he's talking about how, well, ownership loves offering these deals because they think they're offering a deal that's going to provide them surplus value because the player is going to ultimately outperform the amount of money they're being offered as a young player. So that immediately, even if you're like gung-ho about offering both of these rookies contract extensions, you hear the sound of brakes squealing in your head because you're like, we tried that once. Now, granted, these are different players and these are different Phillies and these are different systems and coaches and development and everything. It's far less the chaotic nightmare here that it was when Scott Kingery was getting tossed around by everybody. All that being said, yeah, I was going to ask, where do Painter and Crawford land as far as guys like McGonigal? Because McGonigal's like top of the sport prospect kind of guy, whereas Crawford was viewed as a top Phillies prospect for sure, but he was not a top 10 in baseball prospect, or even maybe not even a top 30. Like, I don't think he was valued very highly because they kept looking at that ground ball rate and everybody kept saying the same problems we were talking about leading into training camp and feeling like they weren't super solvable problems, and that his future may not be in center field, but he ultimately isn't very good at the corners either. So I think a lot of that sort of chewed away at his overall value as far as like prospect lists go. And Painter, I think, is kind of the total opposite, where even after surgery, he was still being valued very, very highly by like Baseball America as a pitcher and everything. But that being said, you're watching Andrew Painter, this poor kid who gets migraines and is coming back from this, you know, still bouncing back technically from this surgery. So, I mean, yeah, it just feels scary early to be talking about this, even with like a massive ticking clock counting down until the CBA negotiations. If I'm going just by what we've seen from these two guys right now, you know, yeah, I'm very encouraged. I'm actually extremely encouraged in Justin Crawford. And I think Andrew Painter's ceiling is still higher, but you're still waiting for him to like work all that out. So like how much do you trust your own projections on the future? Because you'd be projecting these guys, I think, up on the same level as other teams with much higher, like nationally, like universally ranked prospects than you've got. So
yeah.
I don't know. I'm kind of curious what that would mean about what the Phillies even view as their future. Cause I don't even think Dombrowski, he was definitely intending on bringing these guys in, but I think his focus on that really broadened and amplified once Bo Bichette wasn't coming. And suddenly the Phillies were talking about how, well, this is going to be like a youth camp. This is going to be like, we're doing talking about youth. And that was back before Aiden Miller started his lower back problem. So he was going to be a part of that. So I'm just kind of curious, like, what is Dave Dombrowski like, really view as success here, and does he have that instinct to reward it with a long-term extension at this point? I don't know. I don't think just because everybody else is doing it is a good reason, but I also, you know, I don't want to say I'm not encouraged by this. It just feels like, yeah, you said, it just feels very early. It feels very premature.
Yeah, I mean, I understand, you know, Crawford batting .306 to start his career here. Painter is a .377 ERA.
The 9-hole has been the most consistently productive, yeah, spot in the Phillies lineup so far this year. It is April 15th.
Right. But I mean, I think Crawford looks like a guy who isn't going to get into long slumps. Like he's got too much good bat to ball skills in order to avoid long slumps. But I mean, I wouldn't do it right now. I feel like you
haven't even seen him regress. Sorry for cutting you off, but like you haven't even seen him regress, and he's going to regress. And like, that's going to be a big part of this season is watching him, you know, sink back down and then watching him like learn to battle through that and come back out the other side of it. Yeah. That's a huge moment for every rookie. And we're not even there yet.
Right. And I would be more likely to give something to Andrew Painter but just not yet. I want to see because of the injury history and everything else, and the fact that in AAA last year he really did struggle. I want to see a little more before I'm ready to give him, especially because he's a young pitcher who had Tommy John surgery, and he's still, you know, just now looking like the guy who we saw before the Tommy John surgery happened. I'm not ready to jump through to jump in and do that yet. I mean, McGonagall and Griffin and guys like that, They're MVP candidates. I mean, that's their profile. And I think Painter, before the injury and really before his struggles in AAA last year, was looked at as like a number one starter, you know, a Garrett Cole type guy. And so I would have maybe been more open to doing that. But I agree with you, just because other teams are doing it for much more for rookies and young players who I think have more of a certain future of production and excellence. And I don't think anyone can say that McGonagall and Griffin and those kinds of guys, that you don't feel more certain that those guys are going to have star careers, that where they're going to earn that money. I'm just, you know, there's, and for me, there's no harm in waiting for Crawford and Painter to sign contract. Now, maybe by the middle of the year, you know, maybe you do that. Maybe you start thinking about that. You get a half a season under your belt and you see, okay, let's at least get these guys' numbers locked in before the collective bargaining agreement rolls around. But you're right, that Scott Kingery contract is hanging there. They gave that to him before he'd played a game. So at least in this case, you've seen like a half a season at least, and you get a little bit more information. But I agree with you. I think it's early. I think it's too soon. And it's an interesting idea. And I get the idea of cost certainty, but I wouldn't do it now.
Can you imagine locking up Andrew Painter and just having like five pitchers locked up, but not having to think about that for when would be the first time you'd have to worry about that?
Wheeler, probably Zach Wheeler, yeah, after Wheeler. Next year, right?
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. And you know, it might end up happening, but I think the other reason you do it too, is like, if you're worried, like, you know, and why haven't the Pirates locked up Paul Skeens yet? I guess Skeens really does just want to wait till free agency and hit the market,
He's
not going to take a deal like Connor Griffin gave them, you know, 9 years, 140, you know, so interesting that they're able to get something done with Connor Griffin though. And Paul Skeens is probably going to leave for free agency as soon as he can. All right. Well, let's finish up here, Justin, with some final thoughts. Anything else to hit the folks with before we wrap up?
Well, it's funny we're talking about Justin Crawford because back in spring training, he was working on bunting. And that is not an aspect of his game that I think we've seen too much of. But as a speedy young player in the nine hole, I think it's something they wanted. It's a dimension of his game that they wanted to open up. So because of that, I wound up writing an episode of The Dirty Inning about bunting, about the difficulties of bunting, how bunting has been defined over the years, and a Phillies team in 1916 that was aggressively noted for its skill at bunting and using a very what is a very, very rare bunt first offense.
Ah,
that they, like, as I said in the write up, there's no play they wouldn't try to squeeze this team. So it was a really interesting, really interesting story to get into. And we just released that this morning, a new episode of The Dirty Inning about the 1916 Phillies and how much they liked to bunt.
Yeah. And no one bunts anymore. It's one of the things I have thought about, like, especially like in the postseason, when you're in a rut, teams used to try and hit and run their way out of it, right? You're executing hit and runs. Mike Schmidt used to talk about that all the time. Like, when he'd get in a rut, he would ask the manager to put on some hit and runs, because generally speaking, when you got a runner on first and you're trying to shoot a ball through the right side of the hole, and it allows hitters to kind of stay on the ball. Take the pitch. And so a lot of times managers would do that to try and get teams out of a rut, hit and run. Okay, not selling out for power. We're trying to make contact here. I don't see that much anymore. I don't know that you ever really see the hit and run put into play anymore. And you certainly don't see bunting used anymore to sacrifice guys. You never sacrifice a runner from first to second. I'm in total agreement with people on that. For sure. But, you know, there are, like, the suicide squeeze, you know, was an art form back in the day. And that's an exciting play. Like, the suicide squeeze is an exciting play. The safety squeeze is an exciting play. Like, all those different things are a lot of fun. Little parts of the game that have gone away over the last few years. But when you're an offense that struggles like the Phillies and you rely on the home runs, it'd be nice to have another card to play every once in a while.
The bunt, the trying to stretch a single into a double, these are moments in baseball that when they work, you are brilliant and daring, and when they don't, you are stupid and get off the field.
Yeah, as Bryce Harper found out over the last few days, against the Diamondbacks. All right, everybody. Look, that's going to do it for this edition of Hittin' Season. Wish we had better news to share with you about this baseball team, but we don't. But the Phillies will get back at it this weekend for a big series at home against the Atlanta Braves. Well, they'll face two left-handers this weekend. That's not very good. They'll get Chris Sale against Christopher Sanchez on Saturday. That'll be a Saturday night game, primetime game on Fox at 7:15. That should be, even though they're playing poorly right now, that will be a marquee matchup for the Phillies. And then the Phillies and Braves play the Sunday night game on Peacock with Andrew Painter taking the mound for the Phillies on Sunday Night Baseball. So that's at 7:20 Eastern time. So it should be an interesting series. It would be a really good time for the Phillies to get their act together against the first place Atlanta Braves coming to Philadelphia here this weekend. Folks, make sure that you tell your friends and family members about the Hittin' Season podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Overcast, wherever it is you get your podcasts. That's where we are. And of course, you can always find the roundtable shows and little clips of Hittin' Season over at the WHYY YouTube page. Just subscribe to the WHYY YouTube page over on YouTube, and that's how you can find us there. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in. We will talk to you next time right here on Hittin' Season.